keep it moving. Our next speaker is Dr. Claudio Toppelberg, who is Director of the Child Language and Development Developmental Psychiatry Research Project and a research scientist at George Baker Children's Center at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Toppelberg.
Now? Great. Just 1 minute to get set up here. Let me go to the designer where it is. Okay. Okay, I'm going to talk briefly about these different points, describing my path, my research, just with the goal of presenting a few points that I would like to convey. And I want to clarify that I'm earlier in my career path than Michelle is. I do not have an R01 or an R21. I'm in my 3.5 year in my career development award. I just wanted to clarify that. And also that I'm going to be, the way I'm going to be addressing these points is more geared towards people that come from clinical fields. Maybe some of the points may be useful for other people, but particularly for clinical psychologists, other clinicians, physicians, who do not necessarily have the research background or the quantitative background. How about now? Is that better? Yeah? Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so these are the points that I'm planning to cover today. Talk briefly about my path, my research in connection to the points that I'm going to be making before and after talking about my research. The challenges that I think people face and that I face, and tell you a little bit about how I managed the challenges, and also the last point, what's in it for me. Okay, so basically I'm a child psychiatrist. I did my psychiatric training twice. I'm an immigrant, so I trained first in my country of origin in Argentina as a psychiatrist, and I came to this country. I was very interested in child and adolescent psychiatry. I came and retrained as a psychiatrist. I did a child psychiatry training, both of them in Boston. I stayed in Boston my whole stay since I came to this country. And then after my child training, where I started developing some research ideas, I had 1 year of unfunded research experience. It was actually funded by the Toppelberg Foundation, which is my family. We are not funding any more people, so don't apply, please. And then after that, I was lucky to get 3 years of research fellowship, which I always felt was not enough. I had 2 years through the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, PMRTP, Program for Minority Research Training in Psychiatry. And then I had 1 year through the CRTP, which is a Harvard NIMH T34. A clinical research training program, okay? And that's through those 3 years of funding, and even before, I started connecting with the research mentors and advisors and building relationships that you will see were crucial to my development and continue to be crucial. Then I had a very tough period after I finished my third year of fellowship because I did not have any more funding, and I started to apply for the K Award. But before getting that, I was lucky, and then I got into this new streak of being funded through the same mechanism that Michelle mentioned, the minority supplement. Then they gave me an administrative supplement to the R01 of my mentor, Stuart Hauser. And that was very funny because I got 4 years as a junior faculty. I was supposed to get 4 years of funding, which was really generous and really was crucial for me. But then I got the K Award, and I gave it a try to see if I could get both, if I could get the 4 years plus the five, and they said no. So here I am. So anyways, what I wanted to mention is that my K01 is also a K01 for new minority faculty. And I actually, it took me 3 rounds to get funded. So in my case, it wasn't that easy. It was a whole learning process. It was very trying. Luckily for the third submission, the second resubmission, I was funded by the supplement, and I was able to be more liberated to be able to concentrate on working on the grant and really giving my best try. So, but I just wanted to say that there is a whole range of how you get funded. You know, sometimes you get very lucky. And early on, when I was applying for seed money, I was very lucky. I got like 80% of my applications, and I didn't really know what was like to be turned down. And that happened quite a bit later on, and it was harsh. But I think this talks a little bit to one point that I make later on, which is forget about the glamour of being a researcher. I mean, if you're in it because you think you're going to be, I don't know, famous and things are going to be very easy and you're going to be kind of the jet set of mental health, you're wrong. You're completely wrong. So anyways, my work is on young Hispanic immigrant bilingual children in Boston, and it's funded, as I mentioned, by KO1. The project, I named it Childhood Bilingualism and Developmental Psychopathology. I found out that that was a label that lent itself to some confusion, and some people interpreted it as implying that I was saying that childhood bilingualism led to psychopathology, and that's very far from my intent, was very far from my intent at that point, and is far from my intent right now. So but that's just a word about, because once you name the grant, you have to stick with the name. And in fact, this name is completely useless in the field of, you know, working with the subjects. And you'll see that it's a community-based project, and my research assistants just referred to it when they talk to the subjects and teachers as a Harvard language project, because I'll show you in a second, but we concentrate on language. And the Harvard Language Project, which is not a name that I like, because there are like 15 other Harvard Language Projects, some of which do not pay the teachers when they actually promise to pay them. So I don't want to be identified with that. But you know, just think about what names are important, because in the review process, one of the reviewers, in my view, got stuck a little bit with thinking that I was saying something that I was not saying. And it was hard to correct that. And again, I couldn't change the name. So the project is focusing on language competence and also working memory as predictors of mental health status in this population of young children. And I also have an interest in protective factors. Thank you. Okay, thank you. So it's a short-term longitudinal follow-up study of Latino bilingual children of immigrant parents, 228. And also their parents, families, and teachers. Thank you. And we studied the schools also. And the children were recruited from 15 urban elementary Boston public schools. At kindergarten entry, equal numbers of girls and boys. Young kids, mean age 6. And the follow-up, which is taking place right now, is 2 years later when most of them are in second grade. And again, I'm telling you this because I want to illustrate a few points that I'm going to make later on. And it's representative of Hispanic children in the Northeast. Why immigrant children or children of immigrants in this particular case? Because the population of children of immigrants has grown enormously in the last decade or so, as you probably know. When I started doing this work, the typical statistic that I would quote was 14% of the child population were children of immigrants. And right now, depending on the source, it's between 19 and 24%. 19% according to the census, 24% according to the Department of Education. Children of immigrants, most of which are Hispanics, are the fastest growing segment of the US child population. However, we know very little about these children in terms of mental health, and also in terms of language development. And my interest is really the interface of language, normal and abnormal language development, language impairment, and mental health and psychiatric disorders in these children. So one reason why I'm studying these children is because of public health and research disparity implications. But another reason is that I think we know very little about children in general, in fact. Although we know a lot, there is evidence that our research is really coming from a very limited population. 97% of the publications in a study that was done a few years ago in child development are based on children from industrialized societies, while 99% of the children in the world actually come from developing countries or developing societies. So one way to approach the problem is to study children that come from other places in this country. Of course, another way would be to study children outside. We may get the facts wrong about child development. Not only the facts wrong, but as Michael Rutter has been making as an argument recently, and if you're interested in this topic, I recommend his book that he published in 2005 with Marta Tienda, that might be an advantage of to clarify mechanisms in studying ethnic minorities, in the sense that some mechanisms may not work or may not be effective in different child groups, and to understand how they operate really is necessary to be able to look at larger groups and different groups. And I won't be able to get into this, but you know, studying a different population like the one I'm studying allows also for natural laboratories. I mean, one example is that we are looking at the effect of one language on the other language, and this is related to early and later language acquisition, which you cannot really differentiate in monolingual children, you can do in bilingual children. So you can look at whether later acquisition of language can be effective or has some impact of mental health status, which you cannot do in monolingual children. Anyways, this is a complex topic and I won't be able to get into it. So anyways, this is a conceptual model and I will not discuss it in detail, but you can see how simple it is. But you know, the main idea here is to illustrate that to be able to do this, this is not something that I had in my mind when I was in medical training. The idea of coming up with a conceptual model is really strange and you know, very different from what I used to do or what I still do as a clinician. So this is something that I had to learn, and I had to get the input of my mentors and advisors to be able to work on these elements. Otherwise, it was a very simplistic model that was not including other elements that were relevant. Just to increase explanatory power of what I'm doing and what I was intending to do, I had to take into account many other factors. So in order to understand developmental aspects, is the pointer working? Yeah. Developmental aspects and the outcomes, I have a mentor who is a psychiatrist, but he's a developmental psychopathologist. In order to be able to look into language with some depth and competence, I have another mentor who is a developmental psycholinguist. That's okay. And in order to be able to look at non-linguistic risk factors that are specific to this population, I have advisors that have cultural expertise and who have who do research with immigrant population, immigrant children, developmentalists who specifically work in that field. There is a lot of research design expertise that I had to acquire, and I still have to consult with people to be able to continue working with these models that you'll see has to be part of your planning. Anyways, of the whole list of risk factors that we take into account, we really concentrate, we're interested in these ones, but we were including the other ones, and to be able to know what is important in the other areas is where really the input play a very important role. Anyways, let me move forward. Okay. So these are the challenges that I think everybody faces if you're trying to move into a research career and through all the steps towards independence. You have to find the right research mentor. It's a research mentor, it's not a mentor. You can have clinical mentors, you can have career mentors of different kinds, but this is specifically a research mentor. And how do you determine what a right research mentor is? It's somebody with the right level of experience, and that the metric for that, in my view, is somebody who has currently an R01 or who has had R01s at least, or grants that are more important than that, who has a trajectory as being a career development mentor. I mean, it could be a mentor of prior K awardees, but it could be also the mentor of other foundation career development awards. It has to have some significant overlap in the substance of your work, but it doesn't have to be somebody who does your work. In my case, really, it's people that that supplemented each other as in a mosaic to really provide the expertise that I needed. Nobody specifically was working in my area. Then the next step, you have to make sure that you are in a research environment that is conducive to doing your research and having enough of a critical mass around you. And that's a very difficult issue, particularly for people coming from a clinical background. These are not academic departments that are necessarily research-oriented. So I had to move from one hospital where I trained clinically to another place, to the Judge Baker, where I really got the mass, and the place is growing, so I'm very happy about it. What is the metric for the rare research environment, in my view? It's a high productivity in terms of papers, R01s, other big grants, a critical mass of researchers with R01s, hopefully with a postdoc research fellowship on site, so there are people of different different levels of training around you. I think it's necessary to have a postdoctoral fellowship. I think for MDs, ideally, is 4 years, and for other people with clinical training, I think it's 4 years. This may be too ambitious, I'm not sure whether it fits reality or not, but my feeling is that one of the key challenges is to get the methodological and quantitative expertise for clinicians. You really need to have enough coursework and enough hands-on experience. So what I mentioned before is coursework tailored to the substantive areas in statistical expertise, but you have to have direct hands-on experience supervised, mentored by people with significant expertise. And the evidence that you have acquired enough statistical expertise, in my view, is that you are able to conduct and understand your own analysis. I mean, it's not acceptable to say, I don't know what that means, the statistician did it. You see people that present research data that way. I mean, you have to thoroughly understand the methods, the statistical methods, and what the shortcomings are and what the results mean. So people with clinical background, I really want to emphasize that point. And then all the areas of research design that pertain to your area of research, developmental epidemiology and the like, and psychometrics in some cases. This whole piece of the conceptual framework is something that can get to be very trying for us coming from a clinical world. But I think it's very important to put together theoretical models to advance the understanding of mechanisms. And then writing is a whole challenge, and one that I keep struggling with. And again, at least in medicine, you are not expected to write a dissertation in almost all medical schools. So it's a big effort to really get into the groove of being able to write routinely, and it's ideal to have like block times, and the care word is an excellent mechanism to get you into that modality. Anyways, so my last slide is the first point that for some reason is not there, but is on the package. The slides are slightly different. Is forget about the glamour of being a researcher. And go where your passion is, and that's the point. That's the reason why I was presenting the slides about my work first, because there is a lot of sacrifice and counterbalancing that you have to do with your personal life, as opposed to a well-contained professional career, which is also not necessarily perfect, but sometimes allows you to have more of a protected personal life, and I have a family and 3 kids. And by the way, the care award in my particular case was directly related to having the first girl. You can see how things can get intertwined and not necessarily be in a constant conflict, but it's a balancing act, as a dad also. But what I wanted to say is that it's very important that you identify an area that you're passionate about so that all the sacrifices that you would have to make would be less of a burden. Follow the burning question, even if it feels dizzying. And in my case, as a clinician, getting out of the clinic and into the community and getting into developmental, becoming a developmentalist, which is what I consider myself at this point, meant lots of things. And one of them is the fear of losing identity. I mean, recently I asked Michael Rutter how he felt about this fact that he's going to all kinds of meetings. And he says, you know, people always identifies me as an expert in something that I was actually not trained in. I'm not a geneticist, I'm not a child psychiatrist. I mean, and it's interesting, you know, because that's one of the biggest challenges, that you have to be interdisciplinary, you have to, in my case, I think I had to become a developmental psychologist in a way. Of course, I'm not a developmental psychologist by training, but I had to learn many of the tools of the trade that are necessary. You have to be intellectual, but deeply intellectual. Take the time, understand what you're doing. And this goes back to the methodology, particularly for clinicians. You can't be, you know, rushing over the methodological aspects. And then, after that, come back and be a clinician, a physician, and think about how can this help kids really, in reality. And this is the list of my, this is a typical acknowledgement slide, but you see here, Stuart Hauser is a psychiatrist and a developmental psychologist. Catherine Snow is a developmental psychologist who's a psycholinguist. And then you see people with different expertise here. And then the on-staff statistician here, with whom I spend a day a week. And it's also an advisor on research design. Thank you.